The closing market report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for July 26, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And later this half hour, we'll have cash grain analysis with the folks at the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. In agricultural news, sources in China say the PRC will likely increase corn imports in coming years. We'll have this and other stories this half hour. Also, Todd Gleason has some sage advice for pruning roses. And in the second part of the show, the farming world, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with Steve Mercer of U.S. Wheat Associates. It's all on the Monday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Here's how prices settled on this Monday afternoon in Kansas City. September wheat, 612 down 3. December, 629 and a quarter down 2 and 3 quarters. At the Board of Trade, September wheat, 589 and a half down 6 and 3 quarters. December, 621 down 6 and a quarter. September corn, 364 down 7 and a quarter. December, 378 down 6 and a half. March of 2011, 391 and 3 quarters down 6. Go out to July, 408 and 3 quarters. Quarters down 4 and 3 quarters on the day. August beans, 9.98 and a quarter down 18 and 3 quarters. September, 9.74 and 3 quarters down 16 and a quarter. November, 9.66 down 15 and a half. March of 2011, 9.79 and a half down 13 and a half. August soybean meal, 293.20 down 6.70. August soybean oil, 38.80 down 27. August live cattle, 92.65 down 77 and a half. August feeder cattle, 114.95 down 22 and a half. And August lean hogs, 82 even, and they were down 122 and a half on the day. And those are today's settlements in Kansas City and in Chicago.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Leonard's weather highlights, he says showers in western areas will bring light rain into Missouri later today and Tuesday, but Iowa may stay dry until Tuesday night and Wednesday. The best chance throughout the Midwest for rain this week will occur Wednesday and Thursday, with mostly light amounts under 6/10 of an inch, but a few stronger storms will be possible. It will be warm early this week with highs in the 80s to lower and a few middle 90s, warmest in the south, lows at night in the upper 60s and 70s. Dry and relatively cooler air will be present late in the week, that's Thursday and Friday, with highs in the 70s and 80s in the north and 80s and lower 90s in the south, lows in the upper 50s and 60s. Warming with increasing chances for rain will occur again during the weekend and into early next week.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Kurt Kimmel is away, but we have Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities on the line. Thanks for filling in for Kurt this afternoon, Pete.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get your overall impression of the market before we dig into some particulars today. And as you do that, reflect on what phone calls you received today and what people were concerned about.
Well, the big thing is no bad severe weather forecast out there. And as a result of that, a lot of the gains we made in the last few days backed off. We still have corn about in the middle of the range, and beans are still nearer the high than they are the bottom of 2 weeks ago when we had $9 beans and $3.43 corn. So there's still people out there looking to buy corn, thinking it's going to go back to $4. They're still thinking on the beans that we might just be back and forth now. Today's activity was really down quite a bit, and tomorrow will tell us whether it was any kind of a technical thing or not. But we did back off today due just to lack of any poor weather in the forecast.
Can you see corn going back to $4, Pete?
I can't personally, but if you had the forecast turn around and say hot and dry, yeah, I think we could go right back to it. We hit $4.10, what, last week or the week before? And at the time, there were people talking $4.40. So weather is the big thing. What are we going to have? Are we going to have hot and dry, or are we going to have nice weather for growing conditions? Hot and dry would push it back above $4. Good weather conditions, don't think we'll get back to $4.
You think the beans are in a choppy mode, sideways for a bit now?
I think they're also choppy. We had those at the start of this one around $9. They went up almost to $10 in the new crop. The old crop went well above $10, and they closed below $10 today. But again, it's a Monday. What will we do? Well, we have an opposite Tuesday tomorrow to bounce. I think we're still in a choppy sideways range unless we continue to have good forecasts of good weather and moisture, and it won't be too much longer that you know, we won't need much more moisture on corn, and then we'll need the moisture for the beans in August.
Well, if you look at the 10-day forecast and the weather that Drew Lerner was talking about, it doesn't appear that there's anything threatening in that time period, so that's a known, more or less. So I'm wondering how much lower in the near term can the prices go down just on weather?
Well, I think we could go another 15 to 20 on corn, and I think we could go 30 to 40 on beans real easy. Look how quickly we went up on weather when they were saying hot. 2 days' worth of going up a bunch or down a bunch can get you a long way in both corn and beans.
So before the break, or late last week, were there producers that you work with that were trying to take advantage of the little rally that we've seen?
There was a lot more corn that got sold cash last week, and also hedges made last week when we had those prices go over that $4 mark.
How much of that corn do you suppose, if it was old crop, is good?
That's the problem. If you read all the news, they're worried in the ports about all this corn coming to them that's grade 3 instead of grade 2, and they're saying, hey, we don't want any more of that. So there's a lot of stuff that we had to cook to get down to be able to not rot, and that cooking has made it now later into not the best quality corn.
So what will producers do? Because I suspect that as time continues to go by, and if more of this corn comes to the market, there might be a two-tier system for corn coming into harvest this year. And would that be enough incentive for producers to try to, if they can, on their own farm, to blend it themselves?
There is talk of that happening, that farmers that don't have, you know, too much left are going to try to hold some of last year's crop and then blend it with this year's, which is expected to be a lot better, which planted early and harvested in a dry term, not having to be cooked so much. So there is talk of that happening, and I think there will be a lot of it happen. The problem is there's so much of it out there that I don't think that can take care of all of it. So the two-tier thing could possibly be a thing that comes to reality.
What else are you seeing on the basis?
It just depends on where you're at and who needs it. As far as the basis, depending on how bad they need it, I think last week broke out so that we actually got a lot more into the marketplace, whereas it had been pretty tight holding. And I think that's hurt the basis. Just because the prices went higher, the basis widened.
Later this week, Pete, we're going to start getting estimates from different traders. I believe Informa will be out at some point this late in the week about what they expect for the August WASDE and crop production report. What do you think that those early returns might say?
Well, with the weather we've had the last couple of weeks, I think they will be a hair higher than they were on their estimates of crop size than they were the last time.
The other thing of interest to me is that in the August WASDE report, and this was pointed out to me by Jerry Goodell of North America Risk Management Services, they haven't ever put a number above 160 on their August report. Do you think they're going to do that this year?
I don't know that they will. I think when you get above 160, there was all kind of numbers as high as 180. 168. I got that 8 stuck in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that they will change much of anything on those projections unless there's really a big change in what they see.
So you think they're going to keep their powder dry and wait for something more than population counts?
Well, on corn, you know, August 12th, they should have a little bit more than population, but on beans, they won't. I think they might change it a little bit. I think more than anything, they might change the usage numbers a little due to our usage numbers that they get on a weekly basis.
Do you think that week after next we'll see some short covering going into that report?
I think people, wherever they're at, will tend to get out ahead of a report so they don't get ran over whichever way it goes.
What else did you talk to your producers on the phone about today?
Where they're at in their marketing and what's the price there, and do they need to sell some more cash or protect some more with puts or selling calls.
And do you like any particular put and call or call at this particular juncture?
Selling out of the money calls and buying near the money puts if you're going to do it in that manner.
Anything else, Pete, before we let you go today?
No, it's just I think weather forecasts will push and pull it. I think the outside markets today didn't have much of anything to do with anything. Maybe they'll come into play, but the financial markets have settled down a little, so we aren't worried about Europe or all of that every day and to pull it and push it. And I think that settling down has now made it more of a weather market.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities, and he is in Normal, Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In agricultural news, grain consultants in China believe that China's imports of corn will hit 1.7 million tons this year, leap to 5.8 million tons in 2011, and grow by as much as 15 million tons by 2014 to 2015. China has imported the largest volume of U.S. corn this year since at least 1995, following a poor harvest last year and uncertain prospects for this year's crop because of delayed planting in the main growing areas in the Northeast. To help demand of animal feed, China has also massively increased imports of DDGs this year, with 1.146 million tons imported in the first 6 months. That's a 70-fold increase from the first half of 2009. Venezuela President Hugo Chavez threatened Sunday to halt oil sales to the United States if Venezuela is attacked by its U.S. allied neighbor Colombia. The Venezuelan leader cut off diplomatic relations with Colombia on Thursday. Chavez said during a speech to thousands of supporters that if there were an, quote, armed aggression against Venezuela from Colombia backed by the U.S., we would suspend shipments of oil. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says that the U.S. economy is not likely to slip back into recession, But letting tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans expire is necessary to show commitment to cutting budget deficits. Geithner said only 2-3% of Americans, those making $250,000 or more a year, will be affected when tax cuts enacted under former President George W. Bush end on schedule this year. Geithner says, quote, "We think that's the responsible thing to do because we need to make sure we can show the world that we're willing as a country now to start to make some progress bringing down our long-term deficits." PepsiCo Incorporated spent $1.2 million in the second quarter to lobby the federal government on childhood obesity, climate change, and other matters. That's well below the $2.5 million it spent in the year-ago period and the $3.6 million that the soft drink and snack food company spent in the first quarter of 2010. The maker of Pepsi, Gatorade, and Lay's potato chips also lobbied on food safety, labeling, consumer protection, taxes, and other issues in the April through June period. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Pruning roses can be a daunting task. Todd Gleason has a bit of advice from the University of Illinois.
Pruning roses can sometimes be a very confusing task, especially when you have several different types of roses in the garden. There can be hybrid teas, old garden roses, shrub roses, and climbers, says University of Illinois Extension horticulture educator Greg Stack. With this confusion comes doubt, he says, and doubt sometimes leads to improper pruning or no pruning at all. Well, the type of rose you have and the time of year it blooms will influence the type and amount of pruning needed. A general pruning practices can apply to all types of roses, but there are differences between the classes. The amount of pruning between species and hybrid teas is vast, with the species types needing less severe annual pruning and the hybrid teas needing the most severe pruning for optimum flowering. Proper pruning involves several common principles. You should remove dead, damaged, and diseased canes, prune to increase air circulation within the plant and keep the shrub from becoming a tangled mess, and to shape the plant, all done to encourage the growth of flowering stems. Now, most pruning should be done in the mid-spring, says Greg Stack. Wait until the weather stabilized a bit and temperatures are not going to fluctuate too dramatically. He says pruning fundamentals that apply to all classes of roses includes using clean, sharp tools, cutting at a 45-degree angle above an outward-facing bud, and removing all the dead winter-injured canes that can be identified as shriveled, dark brown, or black. After making cuts, seal the ends of the canes with something like, a white glue or pruning paint. This helps prevent disease. If you have hybrid teas, grandifloras, floribundas, and miniatures, producing the best flowers on new or current season canes will require the most severe annual pruning. This usually means removing about half to two-thirds of the plant's height and reducing the number of canes. For modern shrub roses that bear flowers on mature canes that are not old and woody, don't do much pruning the first 2 or 3 years. Old garden roses are often great additions to the garden because they combine a very classic rose flower shape with fragrance that's very hard to match in any other class of rose. Now, these roses are often pruned much the way you would prune modern shrub roses. However, if you have once blooming old garden roses, he cautions gardeners to remember that these roses bloom on old canes produced the season before. The majority of pruning in this class is done right after flowering and not in the spring. Finally, climbers and ramblers may need several seasons in the garden before pruning. In most cases, pruning's limited to removing winter-damaged canes. The difference is in the timing, explains Stack. For once-blooming ramblers, pruning's done right after flowering. Climbers tend to be repeat bloomers, so they are pruned in early spring. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Joining us now with cash grain analysis is Greg Johnson of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. Good afternoon, Greg.
Good afternoon, Dave.
So I'm looking at the temperature out on Will Plaza. It's 84 degrees, cloudy to partly cloudy, to sunny skies kind of moving in and out. Not a lot of wind out there. So how did you do on the front nine over the golf course? Because I imagine the phones weren't ringing, so you probably had plenty of time to get nine in today.
You're right. You're right. They told me years ago when I first started that I'd have plenty of time to learn to play golf, and I still have yet to learn to play. So maybe I should start trying to take a little time off, especially on these down days.
It is a down day, and I imagine because of the decline on the futures, probably not a lot of ringing in the phones. But there are things to talk about, and I think the first thing is soybean basis.
Yes, yes. We've got an extremely high inverted market. Old crop pipeline is very low, and processors and exporters are paying in the neighborhood of 60 to 70 to 75 over the November basis for beans, for old crop beans. And with the pipeline empty, the first week or two of harvest, those new crop beans basically will be considered old crop beans, and there will be some premiums available. The question is, you know, will beans, you know, here in Illinois be the first ones ready to be available to take advantage of that new crop premium, that quick shipment premium? And the answer is probably not. We did get some beans planted in April, but you know, areas to our south and southeast probably will take that. Will be able to take advantage of that better than we can. However, you know, that might, you know, help. It has helped support the new crop basis already. You know, processors aren't buying old crop beans, and so they're starting to pay more for new crop beans basis wise. We've seen new crop basis improve 20 to 25 cents over the last couple of months. And it's not because we have a shortage of new crop beans. It's just because the pipeline is so tight on the old crop beans, it's lending some support to the new crop bean basis. So I think that's one thing farmers can take a look at, is maybe locking in some new crop bean basis. Here in Champaign, for example, we were 40 under the November a couple of months ago. That now has improved to 20 under November. So that's a pretty good basis for this for this fall if you consider that we have a normal crop coming online. The other thing to keep in mind is with Danville, the processing plant in Danville closing down, that's quite a few million bushels of beans that typically go there that are going to have to find a home somewhere else, and that's going to put pressure on everyone else's basis this fall. So for a couple of reasons, I think it might be a good time to lock in some new crop bean basis.
Anything very, very quickly before we get to your prices?
The weather was obviously good. I mean, not everyone got rain, but enough areas in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio got rain. So there are still some dry pockets, but in general, those dry pockets are starting to get less and less. Russia, however, though, is still very dry, and the market is going to keep an eye on that. But so far, so good. One or two more rains, and we'll be in pretty good shape.
All right, let's look at your prices today, then.
Okay, old crop corn down 7 at 352, new corn 348. Old crop beans down 15 at 10.11, new crop beans 9.46. Old crop wheat is 5.49, new crop 6.11.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Greg Johnson of the Andersons in Champaign, Illinois. In 2 minutes, I'll be back with a look at agricultural weather. It's National Coffee Milkshake Day. It's also St. Anne Day, patron of brewmakers. On this day in agricultural history in 1775, Benjamin Franklin became Postmaster General of the United States. In 1799, Isaac Babbitt was born, an American inventor. He created an alloy made of tin, antimony, and copper widely used for friction-reducing bearings. In 1924, he founded a company that became Reed & Barton, the nation's oldest independent silversmiths. In 1866, Beatrix Potter was born, an English author of children's books. Her first and most famous story is The Tale of Peter Rabbit. In 1926, Joseph Engelberger was born. An American engineer, he, along with George Duvall, developed the first industrial robot in the United States. Engelberger is often called the father of robotics, and by 1962, his company, Unimation, installed industrial robots at General Motors. And in 2004, William Mitchell died, an American food scientist. He invented a tapioca substitute during World War II because tapioca was in limited supply. But he is even better known for creating a number of products during a 35-year career with General Foods, including Pop Rocks Candy, Cool Whip, Quick Set Jell-O, and Tang. And that's this day in agricultural history. Listening to the closing market report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Josh.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I am doing well. Thank you very much, sir.
All right.
Well, what the weather giveth the market, the weather taketh away the market.
Yeah.
At least that's how it appears today.
Absolutely. You know, folks in northern Illinois last week were hoping for some rainfall, and then the weekend came, and Friday night in particular, Thursday night far up north, Friday night across the rest of the northern third of the state, and the rainfall totals just over the weekend, highly impressive, 9 to 12 inches in some areas, and obviously that's gone from feast of famine, so to speak, with now potential assessment for damage due to river flooding and potential lodging of corn, et cetera. So the weekend rainfall or the early weekend rainfall was certainly significant and too much too fast in many areas. Now, looking ahead, certainly we don't have a setup over the next several weeks to repeat that in any way, shape, or form. It is a drier pattern this week. We have a front which will move through the central Midwest and notably Illinois on Thursday. It's a light producer, no significant amounts or totals expected there. And again, maybe some pop-up showers over the weekend. But so it's definitely a drier pattern. Certainly for those wet areas over the weekend, they continue to be a net drying phase here, which is certainly beneficial after Friday night.
Light amounts, something, what, 6/10 of an inch or less, that sort of a thing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, what coverage of across the Midwest, and you throw the northern half of Illinois into this category, they get above 4/10, we go 40%. And the upper end of the totals, you get maybe some isolated 1-inch amounts, but it's generally in that 4 to 7/10 range. Exactly, Dave.
So the week will start off fairly warm, and then after the storm system passes through, will cool down a bit and then warm up again by weekend?
It's not even really a cool down, to be honest with you. It's maybe a bit of a dew point change. We got a little bit lower dew points midweek after that first weak front comes through, and then by the weekend it's more pop-up thunderstorms. And you know, this ridge of high pressure, which has been a huge player this summer, and certainly the southeast, more notably than anywhere else in the country, continues to be in the southern and central portions of the U.S. So overall, the bias continues to be for once you get some rainfall coming through, higher dew points and higher temperatures creep in several days thereafter. So it continues to be muggier than normal as we move through the early portions of August.
So are there any real pockets of net drying that will become more common over time or not?
Well, central Illinois is an area that did miss out last week, and if you look at 30-day normals, they're actually trending lower rainfall than normal. And so that's an area, you know, if you get into the first, second week of August, you still have had very minor rainfall amounts. You could start talking about some dryness issues across north central Illinois, not the far northern tier of the state, but that could be a story to develop if they miss out on rains the next 10 days.
Thank you, Josh.
All right, thanks, Dave.
That's Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. And you've been listening to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willag.org, stay tuned for the farming world. This is Dave Dickey.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with the Director of Communications for the U.S. Wheat Associates. His name is Steve Mercer. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Mr. Mercer, if you could tell me first, what's the mission of the U.S. Wheat Associates?
Well, you know, officially our goal, our mission is to develop, maintain, and expand international markets to enhance wheat producer profit here in the U.S. So we do that by working with overseas buyers, providing a number of services to them to make it easier for them to purchase U.S. wheat. And that's important because year to year, we export about half of the wheat produced here in the U.S.
How do you go about doing that?
Well, we have 15 offices around the world and two offices here in the U.S. And really, we work directly with the, in some cases, government buyers, but mainly private purchasers of wheat. So we're working with flour millers. We're working with wheat food processors in about 100 countries. And we have permanent staff, which is somewhat different than some of the cooperator organizations with USDA, in that we feel that relationships are really important. We work directly with these folks, and essentially we try to help them find ways to use U.S. wheat to really improve their enterprises, to increase their profit, and to do a better job introducing new products that that are primarily based on flour developed, processed from U.S. wheat.
You are funded in part through checkoffs?
That's correct. There are 19 state wheat checkoffs around the country. And those state commissions that manage those funds are members of U.S. Wheat. So we have state commission members. They are assessed funding that we suggest. It's perfectly voluntary. I think in most cases, state checkoffs are it's voluntary for producers to provide that money. They can petition to get their checkoff back. That doesn't happen much, but so we're funded by those assessments, and then that qualifies us for funding from the federal government, specifically from USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. And the programs that we use primarily are the Market Access Program and the Foreign Market Development Program. Those programs, really that public-private partnership has been extremely successful over many years. Of course, it was developed in the 1950s when we had a lot of grain commodity production, a lot of supplies, and needed to find ways to sell it overseas. So, you know, in this case, this is a government program that really pays a lot of dividends back to U.S. producers. Specifically for wheat producers, most recently we did an evaluation of the reward that the return that comes back from that investment, and we worked with a nationally known university professor who has done a number of studies on the value that accrues back to producers from programs like ours. So using that model, which is proven, what we found is that for every dollar that producers provide to U.S. wheat, now that includes direct funding from the checkoff as well as in-kind contributions, for every dollar, $23 comes back to the producers directly in net revenue increase. And that increase comes from higher prices for wheat. But the benefits go beyond just producers. When you look at the investment that is made in the work that U.S. wheat does, we saw in this study that about $150 come back to the U.S. economy. And, of course, that would be the wheat supply chain all the way from the the private exporters at the export locations, to the transportation system, to country elevators, and back to producers. So this is a very, very successful public-private partnership.
How much is the checkoff? I know it's on the first sale of the bushel of wheat, but how much is that checkoff?
It does vary by state. Each individual state has their own methods of collecting, and it varies from maybe a quarter penny up to maybe 2 cents a bushel in some cases, so it does vary. It runs, the direct contribution runs about just about $5 million total that comes to U.S. Wheat, and an additional $5 million comes in through in-kind contributions. So, you know, our state organizations will host trade teams that we bring, and that is expenses that they incur directly. So, you know, total producer contribution is about $10 million, and then the total contribution that we get from the market access program and foreign market development program and other government programs is about 10. So it's about $20 million. You know, this is an industry, the wheat exports, of course it varies according to price, but generally speaking, it is about a, you know, between $5 and $7 billion industry every year on average. So for $20 million investment, bringing, you know, $5 to $7 billion back to the U.S. economy, that's money well spent.
How long have you been involved with the U.S. Wheat Associates?
I started with the organization back in 2006. We are, you know, our organization started as two separate legacy organizations, really back in 1959. So, wheat export market development has is over 50 years old. And then those two organizations was Western Wheat Associates and Great Plains Wheat merged in 1980. So this is actually U.S. Wheat's 30th year providing that mission to enhance producer profit through building markets for wheat producers.
How is it that you differ, for instance, from the National Association of Wheat Growers, or NAWG?
Yeah, well, basically, the National Association of Wheat Growers has a number of affiliate state organizations, and NAWG is the acronym, is primarily focused on being the voice for producers here in Washington, D.C., and those individual state affiliates are speaking for producers in the state capitals. So they are, a simple way to put it would be, they are the lobbying organization, the domestic lobbying organization for wheat producers. They receive some funding from commissions, but the primary source of funding for NAWG and the state affiliates is through membership dues. So there is a misunderstanding in some cases that if you are paying your checkoff dollar for wheat, that makes you a member of the state affiliate and the National Association of Wheat Growers. That's not actually the case. So it's really important for producers who are making that choice to remember that to increase their voice domestically, they need to be members of those state associations and, of course, to represent their product overseas. The support for the checkoff is very important.
I understand that you're primarily involved with promoting exports of wheat outside of the United States. I'm wondering, though, how things have changed for your organization over the last, I don't know, 15 years, since the 1996 Freedom to Farm Bill was put in place. Wheat acres in some states have dropped dramatically in the United States. Kansas, for instance, a wheat state, is now a corn state. In Illinois, we're down to some 300,000 soft red winter wheat acres, and we were over a million at one point.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that there's a very strong competition for acres going on. And, you know, we look at it primarily as corn, oilseed crops, soybeans, canola, et cetera, and wheat. And really what is driving that to a very large extent is first profitability, because generally speaking, corn, soybeans, other crops do tend to be more profitable than wheat. And what's driving that in part is biotechnology. The biotechnology traits have been a tremendous boon for those crops. Of course, you also have growing demand for ethanol for corn, but biotechnology traits have been very beneficial for those other crops. And of course, wheat currently has no biotechnology traits in the U.S., nor in the world for that matter. Things are changing because in the last couple of years, U.S. wheat producers, and in fact, producers from Australia, Canada, a number of other countries have decided that we need to open the crop to new technology and specifically to biotechnology. So with that support from producers, the technology providers, public and private, are beginning to reinvest in wheat. And I think that we're still probably 5 to 10 years away from having biotechnology traits in wheat. But in the meantime, this new infusion of resources, cash specifically, we're very excited about that because I think we're going to see a number of traits, even from conventional breeding, that are going to improve the crop, not only the quality, of course, but yields as well for producers. I think the difference for wheat now is going to be that much of the trait technology research is really focused on not so much on herbicide resistance, somewhat less for insect resistance, but really the focus is on developing traits that allow wheat to produce to its maximum potential in drought situations, to use nitrogen more efficiently, and in some cases salt tolerance. In Australia, for example, there has been a number of years of drought trend and has caused salinization of the soil, so that is a huge problem there. Some of the other traits that we expect to begin to look at and see are going to be some disease resistance, scab, fusarium, head blight can be a very significant problem in wheat. In a wet year near harvest, as the wheat develops, it can be a pretty bad issue in Illinois, for example, in soft red winter, because fusarium is a similar, it affects corn as well. So the inoculum is always out there. So these are some of the things that we're looking at. And in the case of exports, we have a job to do as an industry and U.S. wheat specifically, to talk to our customers overseas about what that means and how that will change the wheat that is going to be offered into the world market.
You're listening to The Farming World. Our guest is Steve Mercer of the U.S. Wheat Associates. More when we return.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, Japan's finance ministry today says that Japan's exports rose for the 7th straight month in June, driven by machinery and steel products, indicating that overseas demand continues to underpin recovery in the world's number 2 economy, even amid a stronger yen. Exports climbed 27.7% from a year earlier to 5.87 trillion yen, that's $67.2 billion. Exports to China, Japan's biggest trading partner, rose 22% in June, while those to the U.S. were up 21.1%. The Bank of Korea today says that South Korea's economic growth slowed in the second quarter of 2010, despite gains in exports. Gross domestic product expanded 1.5% in the 3 months ending June 30th. The Lundberg survey today says that the average price for a gallon of gasoline in the United States rose less than a penny over the past 2 weeks. The national average for regular unleaded gas rose to 2.7336, up 0.77 of a cent per gallon from the level notched 2 weeks ago. The current price is about 25 cents above its year-ago level. The rise comes as crude oil prices climbed $3 per barrel between July 9th and July 23rd. At $3.17 a gallon, San Francisco had the highest average price for regular unleaded gasoline among cities in the lower 48 in the July 23rd survey. Charleston, South Carolina had the lowest average price at $2.47 a gallon. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with the Director of Communications for the U.S. Wheat Associates. His name is Steve Mercer. Mr. Mercer, when we left, you had just taken up the topic of biotechnology. It has not been incorporated into wheat. You suggest that'll happen in the next 10 years in some ways that will happen. One of the jobs that U.S. Wheat Associates will have will be to convince the export market that it's okay to purchase wheat that has been genetically modified. What are those conversations like?
Yeah, I think among the conversations that we're having, you know, I think in some ways it's not so much trying to sell wheat with biotechnology traits as it is to help them identify ways to purchase the wheat that they want. We believe that the marketplace will create an opportunity to offer wheat that has biotechnology traits or was grown with biotechnology traits. And wheat that is non-GM, if you will. The critical question there becomes, around the world, how can we work with local regulatory officials and international standard setting bodies to accept a minimum tolerance of the presence for GM wheat. Once GM traits are produced commercially, there is the risk, of course, that it will be in any shipment, whether that shipment is non-GM or not. So we have to develop levels of minimum acceptance for that. And that's not the case in some areas right now. So that's one thing that's really critical. But we're helping our customers overseas understand that they will be able to buy the wheat that they want. Prices, you know, may change or very various characteristics, but we're committed to providing choice to those customers overseas, but we're also committed to allowing our producers to use the technology that's available to produce the crop. And we believe that without developing biotechnology traits that have the potential to increase benefits to producers, to make wheat more profitable, that U.S. wheat production will continue to decline. I mean, where yields are going up somewhat, that offset those limited number of acres or reduction in the number of acres that are being planted. But, you know, we see that separation beginning to happen over time if we're not able to compete with corn and soybeans for other acres.
Right. It's easy enough for consumers not to see corn and soybeans, I think, as a product that they consume directly, though it's in many of the products that they have and do eat and have for the last, you know, since 96, 95. Wheat is seen as bread. It's much more difficult, I would think, to enhance those products genetically and to have consumer acceptance. But when you talked about the traits that were in the pipeline potentially for wheat, they were the same types of traits that corn and soybeans would be working on. Those would be in the same category, I suppose, traits that would help production and not offer benefit that the consumer might see readily. Are there things that might be in the pipeline that the consumer would be more accepting of a genetically modified crop?
At this point, most of the work is being done on what I would term, as you put it, producer benefit traits. Partly because if the producer can't benefit from biotechnology, the benefits are not going to go on forward to the end users. There is work being done. We know of a university in California has partnered with a technology provider to begin to look really closely at the issue of celiac disease, so gluten intolerance. And that's a combination of both biotechnology research but also conventional breeding. So that is one area that once the revenue that can accrue to the technology producers and to the wheat producers themselves, and then they move on to more consumer-oriented traits. Now, others will be, of course, could be shelf life for the flour, could be various characteristics that enhance the bread and other products. But initially it has to be producer benefit, but there definitely will be, as we move on, there will be consumer benefits as well.
Well, I have a secondary question. Are there states where producers ask for consumer benefits? And I would think that those would be states that don't see choice in alternative crops. So Montana, Wyoming, as opposed to maybe Kansas and Oklahoma and the Dakotas.
There's no doubt that consumer benefit traits will eventually be pursued. Absolutely. We believe that that's going to happen. There's a large number of organizations that are concerned mainly about supply, continued reliable supply, that are working together to try and find the most beneficial path forward for customers and for their own industries.
Mr. Mercer, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Steve Mercer is with U.S. Wheat Associates. He's been our guest here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Dave Dickey does our booking. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.